Hello, everyone. Welcome to A French Village Podcast. I am here with my brilliant friend, Benjamin Wittes. Ben, how are you?
I am really grateful to not be a foreign Jew in France in 1942, which is to say, I do not have meningitis, real or fake. I am not locked in a school building on my way to Drancy, and furthermore to Auschwitz. And I am free to practice whatever distorted version of Judaism I think appropriate. So I'm pretty good.
Good, yeah. You know, last week, I remember saying, and this is funny of me because I have seen this before, so I should have remembered, but I was sort of complaining that there wasn't enough, you know, whether it was from the resistance or other people, by Cremieux, I think specifically I was talking about, you know, why there wasn't more of an attempt to spring some of the people from the school, make some daring, you know, escape plans. And then I just had forgotten that that's what they do for the last two episodes of both that we watched, which are the last two episodes of when everybody's in the school, when they're continuing to keep the Jews in the school, continuing to do the roundups. And that sort of brings us to the mid-season point. So both episodes contained sort of daring escape attempts. Did you think, what did you think about the meningitis plan?
Well, so I don't know enough medicine to know how plausible or realistic it is, honestly. It didn't work all that well, which is to say it works for exactly long enough to get her out of, this is Hélène Cremieux, it works exactly long enough to get her out of the encampment and breaks down on the other side of the fence when the head measuring so-called doctor figures out that the spots on her neck are actually lipstick. So I don't know how easy it is to fake bacterial or viral meningitis, and whether, you know, in 1942 you could fake it well enough to fool a quack doctor and some gendarme and Nazi soldiers. You know, it is the case that there were lots of escape attempts from, you know, transits, and some of them were successful and most of them were not. And so I do think to the extent that there's some license in the specific portrayal of this family's effort to save their daughter, I think it's pretty forgivable license, but I don't know enough, you know, enough of the medical side to have any sense of whether the specific portrayal is plausible. We should ask, you know, JVL that, because, you know, unlike me, he was rejected from medical school, so he knows more about this stuff than I do.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much he knows about meningitis. I certainly don't know anything. I guess it was as good of an attempt as any. I mean, you know, I would say there's something in these two episodes, whether it's that you're kind of exhausted by the intensity of the awfulness of it. I mean, one of the things that is kind of in the background of the episode, but is there to just give you a sense of the horror, is that there's a couple who'd been being kept at the school who had committed suicide, and their bodies are just being left in the school where everybody is still being held.
And you learn, I think, spiritually important. You learn that these are Polish Jewish refugees who realize they are going to Poland.
That's right.
And they commit suicide.
And so not only that, you learn that they're both lawyers, which I found, were there women lawyers in the 40s? And so I guess.
I don't know what the Polish legal profession looked like in the 40s. Sorry, I can't help you with that.
Well, so here, but yes, the thing that there is this conversation that happens between, I guess, Sarah and Hortense kind of over the bodies or like in adjacent to it. And Sarah just says, you know, they were both lawyers. And when they heard we were going to Poland, they committed suicide. Or they exchanged glances. Like it was something actually even more subtle than that. There was a look in their eyes. And right, these were people who knew what was awaiting them.
Yeah. So this is an allusion to something, and it is not 100% clear what it is, but here are a couple possibilities. So first of all, we do not know when these people came from Poland to France. So one possibility is that they came earlier, sometime before the war, and this is just some kind of premonition on their part that nothing good could mean nothing good if Nazis are sending Jews to Poland. The second possibility, which is how I read it, is that they were recent refugees. Remember, Poland was the first country invaded at the beginning of World War II in Europe begins with the Nazi invasion of Poland in 39. And when they went in, they began killing Jews immediately. It was not like, it was not at all like what happened in France. There were immediate large scale massacres, mostly by machine gun. And one of the reasons that the Wannsee Conference happened in early 42 was that this sounds sick to say, but it's really true. The emotional toll on the SS people for overshooting so many Jews in cold blood was high enough that the SS actually decided it needed a more antiseptic way to kill very large numbers of people. And that's where the structured death camp setup came from. And so one possibility here, and this, by the way, continued all the way through 1941, when as the German troops move ever eastward, they move into what's called in Jewish history, the Pale of Settlement, which is this large strip of land in what's now Ukraine, Russia, Belarus, and Poland, where just millions and millions and millions of Jews lived. This was the center of the Jewish world up through Vilnius, which in Lithuania, which was the sort of great center of Jewish learning. This is the densest, largest population of Jews in the world. And it's where, you know, the locus of the Holocaust happened. And so as German troops move east, they are just killing enormous numbers of people. And it's mostly not in the early stages in what we think of as the Holocaust, like death camps and stuff. It is mostly in by two means. One is mobile gas chambers on the backs of trucks. They're just packing people in and driving around and gassing them that way with the exhaust into the trucks. And the other is by bringing people out into forests and just shooting very, very large numbers of them. The largest single, I believe, massacre of the Holocaust takes place when the Germans reach the capital of what is now Ukraine, Kiev, and they basically take 50,000 Jews into a park at Babi Yar and shoot them. So one possibility, I suppose, this is a long-winded Holocaust history way of saying, one possibility is that these are recent immigrants or migrants from Poland who somehow in 1939 managed to flee west and south and get to Paris and get to France and know exactly. They may not, they don't know about Auschwitz, but they know that what's happening to Jews in Poland is super, super bad. And so they would rather control the circumstances of their own deaths rather than be packed off to it. And I don't know which is the right way to understand this. If there may be listeners who have a better sense of who these people are being intimated to be than I do. But I think it's kind of one of those two.
Yeah, I think I was trying to think about how to discuss these two episodes because they're hard in the sense that they are, the horror is at the edges. It is in things like the suicide of the two people, of those lawyers. It is in the cruelty of Marchetti sort of lying to Rita and having her mother sent. It's the arbitrariness of who gets saved and who doesn't, but they're kind of wrapped, both episodes, in like a heisty kind of energy to save specific people, particularly characters that we know and are fond of. And so it's easy to kind of become attached to, you know, the efforts to get them out, as that's like sort of the narrative. But they are still, you know, at the end of the episode, at the end of the episode two, when Berio, I remember this, like this is another one of those sort of haunting things where he's in the school and it's empty now because they've all gotten on the train. And he's just sort of sitting in it and saying, clean it up. But you can see all of the things people left behind, all of the belongings that they couldn't take with them. Because one of the things that you kind of keep hearing people say over and over again is you can't really take money. You can only take 20 pounds. You know, you only get one bat, you know. And so much is left behind. And then there's just this empty school where all these people used to be. And they're just gone. And we know where they're going. But the story is about everything that happens as people are trying to break people out. You've got multiple escapees. You've got Cohn and his daughter, who we saw get out the previous episodes, but circle back in this one. There is the resistance. Cremieux wants to get his daughter out. Obviously, he'd like to get both his wife and daughter out, but they have a plan to get the daughter out because she is sick, because she has a fever. They think that they can fake meningitis and get her evacuated from the camp, primarily because the Germans wouldn't want somebody who has a deadly contagious disease near them. And so they're figuring out that way. And then in the next episode, Hortense, in an incredibly unlikely, not at all in line with her character necessarily, she goes at Daniel's, basically in his stead, she goes to the school to give Sarah some things, some money, some clothes. And she sort of just walks into the camp and then switches clothes with her so Sarah can walk out. And I got to say, I think part of what I didn't love these two episodes. I just don't like them that much, in part because all the horror is at the periphery, but you still feel it. It's still omnipresent in the episodes. But also, I found both of the rescues, whatever, stunty and kind of silly and not particularly plausible in my mind. Like, I'll just take the Hortense one, where she just, like, they have made a whole thing about how it's very, like, just in the previous episode with Marie, like, it's, she has to have a whole backstory to get into this camp to even see her, right? They're, like, not letting her in, but she's pretending to be a nurse. The principal is vouching for her. You know, she's got she's got Lucienne engaged to go get a soldier to help get her in. And then in the next episode, Hortense just kind of walks in and to give stuff to Sarah. And then when Sarah does change, they like switch IDs and switches clothes, and then Sarah just kind of walks out, at which point, you know, Hortense does get a dose of what it's like to be treated as a Jewish person inside this school where a German officer is screaming at her, you know, threatening to hit her, calling her a Jewish pig, all this stuff. But of course, ultimately we find out she too is then let out because Servier comes and bails her out. And Hortense the whole time, I mean, this is plausible enough that she feels protected by her status, who she is, that she's married to the mayor, so that she knows that, I guess, she can get out. But I did find both of the attempts at escapes not particularly plausible. So that was...
So I agree with that. I think they are not the most narratively tight episodes, and they do ask you to accept some... suspension of disbelief / improbabilities. That said, if you read the accounts of people who escaped and how, both from in the context of the resistance and in the context of the Holocaust, those stories are really improbable. You know, it's just we have the stories of the people whose improbabilities came to be and, you know, were improbable but happened anyway. Not the stories of people whose escapes were improbable and therefore didn't work and they got shot. And, you know, I read one of the earlier episodes, I read from the obituary of a resistance figure named de Rochefoucauld. And, you know, he escaped from the SS, you know, dressed as a nun, which is not very different from, you know, what Marie is doing here. And so I agree, all of these stories individually seem fantastical, and yet there were escapes, and they were daring, and they were improbable. They succeeded relatively rarely, but the ones that succeeded were people trying crazy things in desperate circumstances.
Yeah. There's this, the other thing is there, like I was talking about the arbitrariness kind of who survives. It literally happens at one point that Marchetti arrests Berio, has the Lariat, the other cop, who's kind of he's always around, has one of the gendarmes who says that what they carried out the printing press, that they, you know, he's diming them out for the printing press they had a few episodes ago. Marchetti wants him to bring Berio in. He does. He's there for questioning. Lariat's got the gendarme there too. And then Marchetti walks in and he's all bent out of shape over what's happening with Rita and trying to get her free, that he kind of... he ends up just flipping a coin. Like, he just, like, says, ask Berio, like, call heads or tails. And he flips it. Berio calls heads. It's heads. So he just lets him go and, like, yells at Lariat. And it's just... Yeah, I don't know. And he repeats it, weirdly, in the second episode, too, where then he lets Sophie and Mr. Cohn go. And this is... I think what I don't like about these episodes, actually, is that in both Hortense's case, maybe you have a different perspective on this, but in both Hortense's case and in Marchetti's case, they both sort of make big gestures that are totally out of step with who we've come to know them as characters. And so between the heistiness elements and then sort of characters doing things that don't seem in line with who they are, I found them difficult to get my to grapple with. But what
that's
did you
interesting.
Think?
Well, I thought the Marchetti thing actually bothered me less. It has an explanation.
It does.
And the explanation, as I read it, is, look, this is a guy who is infinitely corrupt. And he has spent these two episodes and the previous two extorting a mother for sex with his daughter, betraying the daughter after the sex, getting the mother arrested and sent to, you know, her death or whatever they think it is. And he is now, and he does it without a whole lot of hesitation, but he is not, Mueller. He is not a sadist who particularly enjoys this. He's merely infinitely corrupt. And so he feels guilty about it. And now he is confronted, having betrayed the mother and the daughter. And by the way, the daughter doesn't know she's been betrayed. So she's living in his apartment and sleeping with him. And now he is, he feels guilty about it. The train has left and the Gestapo has left with it. So there's no immediate pressure to arrest more Jews. And these two escapees walk into his office or are brought into his office. There's no value to him in detaining them. They've already met their quota. Servier is satisfied. The Gestapo is gone from the town. So there's no value to him in following the rules here and detaining them. And so he gets to alleviate his guilt at no cost to himself. And I think that's exactly the circumstance in which a grand gesture makes sense for a person who is infinitely corrupt, but has a little bit of enough of a conscience to want to be able to tell themselves that he's a good guy, which Mueller does not, by the way. Mueller actually enjoys torturing the wife in front of the husband for purposes of right? Marchetti is a horrible person, but there's no evidence that he enjoys particularly being that horrible. He just does it because it's in his self-interest.
Yeah, I think that there's no doubt. I agree with that he, at the end, shows the kindness to Sophie, the young girl, because he doesn't just let them go or not detain them. He gives them a pass.
And he
tells them, gives them a backstory.
He works on their backstory.
Gives them a backstory and then and tells them where to go. But I agree that it's quite clear that there is an attempt to alleviate guilt for himself there. And to feel like he is has the ability, because he's still sort of like that egomania that comes with being able to confer mercy. I agree that it is more plausible for him. The Hortense one though, let me just tell you, because I'm sorry that I'm going to spend this whole episode picking apart things in ways that I narratively thought they were extremely weak, but like. From the beginning, okay, so Larche, Daniel, loves Sarah and somehow manages to send Hortense instead of going himself for like a reason that they give you, which is just, Daniel's not going to get to see her anyway.
They think it's a higher chance that a woman gets into the camp to see a woman than that the mayor gets in to see his people. It's not entirely clear, but that part didn't bother me particularly. The escape, the ease of the, Hortense having a conscience, which, is itself doubtful. I don't know. Go on.
I just didn't buy this idea that, first of all, or that Daniel would take a pass on seeing her. that he would be desperate. And he's the mayor, and he has this, you know, of all the people who could potentially get in. So anyway, I just sort of didn't buy that. It seemed like a weird, and it seemed like an explicit setup to get Hortense in there so she can do this thing that, to me, you know, is Hortense acting in a way that is not just contrary to her character, but is like, it is self, like she's risking herself, right? And so for somebody who through the show has been selfish and self-interested at absolutely every step, the grandiosity of this particular gesture makes no sense to me. What did you think?
I thought this was a weak part of the episodes, both as a portrayal of Hortense's character. She's gone from, you know, sleeping with every disreputable person in the town to, you know, to trying to rescue Sara, whom she knows to be Danielle's lover at this point. And there's not a particularly coherent explanation for that change. And then also the ease with which she gets into the camp and the ease with which she's able to switch identity cards with Sara strikes me as implausible. That said, I found it forgivably so. You know, there's a bias, with the apparent exception of the Cremuse and Madame Morhange, the show has a bias toward the survival of its own characters. And I think you have to discount a little bit realism and keep in mind the aggregate numbers, right? So this is, you know, several dozen people among one of many transports that are taking place in the summer, in July of 1942. And, you know, a few characters get out. They happen to be the characters that get out, that happen to be the focus of the show. But you have to always remember that the Sara Meyers of the world, by and large, by a two-thirds to one-third majority, did not survive the war. The Madame Morhanges of the world, one-third to two-thirds in France anyway, did survive the war. In Poland, 90% of all of them are killed.
Yeah.
But in France, the foreign Jews die by a 2-to-1 ratio. The French Jews survive by a 2-to-1 ratio. So you got to keep in mind the aggregate numbers, but it's also fair for the show to say, hey, we can't kill all our main characters. And so there's a bias in the show towards survival of the people the show is about.
Yeah, I'm not objecting to springing Sara. I'm just giving Hortense, me too, giving Hortense this, I remember as the show proceeds and everything else, I have always thought of this episode in particular, that moment for Hortense, as a incongruent,
yes,
moment in who she is. And I also, I think there's something where, like, it's not that I don't think bad characters. I always sort of felt this way about Jaime Lannister in Game of Thrones, not to like mix up our shows here.
Oddly, a little bit like Hortense, actually.
Yeah, who like there is a, I'm just sorry, spoiler alert on Game of Thrones for anybody listening, but like there is a terrible rape scene that the makers of the show tried to say wasn't a rape scene, but I, when someone's saying no the whole time and also is his sister, I'm going to go ahead and say that that is a pretty textbook. And then they like rehab him in this way where he becomes this likable character. And I just think once you've, I don't know, I like this is, Hortense doesn't get like big redeemable moments at this point.
Right.
At least ones that aren't earned. Like you have to really earn some redemption if you're going to do it.
But okay, I do think Hortense, what the show insists on throughout is that the good guys do bad things. De Cavern is a good guy. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't always act like a good guy. And the bad guys sometimes do good things. Hortense is a bad guy. She's trying to win her husband back, oddly, by helping rescue his lover. She's trying, you know, she never does anything for unself-interested reasons, but she's trying to show Danielle that she will sacrifice for him and take risks for him, because for some reason, having betrayed him in every way that you can betray a marriage, she sort of still feels that she doesn't want him to reject her. She seems offended that he's rejecting her. And so she's trying noble gestures with respect to him. And of course, like a lot of people, she continues to underestimate the Nazis. She's underestimating the level of evil that she's dealing with. And so she's surprised when, you know, when a Gestapo officer behaves toward her the way Gestapo officers behave.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was maybe one of the few satisfying moments in these episodes, actually, because not that you want to see the Nazis mistreat someone or even bad characters be mistreated in that way, but you do, it is, there's something about Hortense having to see up close and experience what people are going through that that should be eye-opening for her, and like you are glad to see that she is forced to confront how hideous and horrible the treatment is. So there's a couple, and I think, so part of it too is that I think both of the Marchetti decision and the Hortense decision are meant to be your emotional release valves for all of the tiny ways that these two episodes crush your spirit. And so I guess the spirit gets crushed in these, and those aren't, for me, adequate trade-offs. And so let me tell you what I mean in part. The attempt to get Helene out is a failure. So they do this, then the meningitis thing, you know, they use lipstick to do the spots, and the quack head measuring doctor is just around, and they get him to argue for them. But then as he's walking her to the car, he somehow touches her in a way that gets the lipstick on his fingers and realizes it's a fraud and sort of blows the whistle. Kid runs off. Helene runs off, goes to Lucienne's house where they're trying to, you know, the kid is genuinely sick. And so they're trying to kind of nurse her back to health. But then Berio shows up. The Germans are searching. There's a lot of Germans searching throughout these two episodes, but the Germans are searching for her. And so they end up having to like lock her in that closet. And
it's the same closet.
And I will tell you, these are one of my favorite things about this show. Is that this show does a very good job with its sets creating for the audience a sense that you know the town and the location and like the crevices of places where these people exist. And so the fact that we had already had a whole storyline about this particular closet and how, you know, no one had the key and that's where the Christmas decorations are supposed to be held or the birthday celebration. I can't remember exactly, but like, you know, that closet. and so when they put her in there, like you have a sense just for what it is. So I do like that about the show. But the Germans come in and they pull back. Lucienne is sort of very pregnant now in bed. They pull back the covers and find the Helene's got a little toy, you know, lamb that she's like a stuffed animal. They find it and it, you know, tips them off that Helene is probably somewhere. They start looking. They try to get in the closet. No one's got the key. Lucienne kind of fakes going into labor. So that to get rid of them, and it works there. But then Berio leaves and that fake labor turns into real labor. And so now it is Lucienne is alone with Helene, goes into labor and is like,
and passes out in pain.
And Helene is put in this horrible position of having to give herself up by going for help. which she does, and the Germans are still there, and they are waiting for her, and they take her away. And so the entire episode that has built the plot towards getting this young girl out is quashed, and she is given back to her mother. And that is, you know, it's just a, it's just one of the, it's just it is sort of a crushing loss, because you want her to get to her father, who you know is with Marie, and they're all putting themselves on the line for it. And so, yeah, I just found it, you know.
Yeah, so there's one redeeming feature of this horrible sequence, and that is Lucienne, who has finally shed her, what my French pronunciation coach, Eve Goumont, calls goldfish energy. And this, you know, this young woman who is like starts the show as like a list of bad life choices, you know, generally very costly ones, is now not only tolerating her husband's resistance activity, she is actively hiding this child. She is doing a great job faking labor to get rid of the Gestapo, which, by the way, can get you killed. And she's delighting in it. There's a wonderful little moment where she's faking the labor. They get, you know, the Gestapo guys flee in terror because there's nothing more scary to, you know, machismo than a woman in labor. And you know, Berriot lies her down in the bed in this demonstrative show for the fleeing Gestapo guys. And then they exchange a grin as they're out the door, a big hug. And then Berriot says, "One more?" And she screams in pain again with a big smile on her face. It's Lucienne's best moment in the show so far, I think. And I think and after Hélène is recaptured and the baby is born, she's the one who's crying because, you know, yeah, she got her baby delivered safely, but the objective was not achieved. And Berriot is trying to comfort her and says, "We did everything we could," which is totally true. But, you know, her tears represent the idea that everything you could isn't good enough, which is, I think, a lot of what the good guys in the show are experiencing a lot of the time. And so I thought actually that was one narrative thread in the show that worked in this episode that worked really well, and that I thought were redemptive in a serious way toward a character that I've, you know, rather disliked up until now.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons I end up defending Lucienne in the earlier episodes is that obviously I have a more holistic view of her throughout the show. And, you know, this is a good example of a character kind of earning their arc, earning their redemption narratively, where it is slow over time and a series of choices that make sense and loyalty shifting. And like, there's another moment actually where she kisses Berriot for like, what is probably not the first time, but like maybe the first time, like with any amount of real, genuine, either passion or affection. And it is also, and it comes from the place of them doing this thing together that they both value. And I think like that, I find that part all believable, that they're being brought together by both doing something that matters to them in this moment.
Yeah, and, you know, Berriot continues to grow in the estimation of the viewer, at least of this viewer. He's got his quirks, but on all the biggest things, he's right where you would want him to be. and in a very Marie-like way without asking a lot of questions or spending a lot of time thinking about consequences. He's just doing what needs to be done. He's very brave when they bring him in for questioning about the printing presses in that scene that you referred to earlier. He's, they ask him about his Freemasonry past and he responds, you know, if you say so. Like he seems to actually not be that afraid of them. He's like doing the things that need to be done in difficult circumstances, including caring for his wife when she's 8 months pregnant and has a sick kid hiding from the Gestapo in their apartment. So like, you know, he's like, we should take a moment to appreciate Berio as well as Lucien.
Yeah, agreed. There's one other sort of crushing moment, a small moment that's like, to me, was just too bleak for words. And it is when Servier comes shortly before the train is leaving, and he comes to thank Mrs. Morhange for how wonderful she's been and all the service that she's provided. And to see her, she's not like glowing in his praise, but she is, you know, it's nice to be thanked. Probably. But there's just something so awful about what Servier has done to her. And she, in fact, you know, while Sarah is spared from this, as is Mr. Cohn and Sophie, Morhange is gone. She's been put on the train. And so this idea of Servier thanking her, and like, yeah, we really couldn't have done this without you. There's a real knife twist in that. And Helene and her mother, so both Cremieux's wife and daughter, are gone. Just gone.
Yeah, so Servier continues to be one of the most disgusting people in the show. There's a interesting, I think, there's several interesting aspects of his behavior in this. The first is, as you point out, that he's, you know, thank you. I won't forget you, mm-hmm. Madame Morhange, though I know you're a French Jew and you shouldn't be here at all. And I've done nothing to get you out. Thank you for all your help in making these people cooperate with my efforts to get them out of my jurisdiction so the Nazis can kill them without me having to be involved. Thank you. I really appreciate it. I'll keep your situation in mind and I'll raise it. He continues to be the most disgusting of the French officials. He also knowingly or unknowingly lies to the people about where they're going. They have figured out that they are going to Poland. And he tells them the lie, which was, in fact, this is real, that they are going to Drancy, which is the French transit camp that we discussed last week. And he tells them that it was built for gendarme barracks and families, which was actually true. That's why it was originally built. It has been, it functioned not as a labor camp or as a, you know, as a internment facility, but as a detention transit camp on the way to gas chambers. And so he basically calms them down, telling them you're not going to Poland. You're going to, you know, a facility built for the gendarme on the outskirts of Paris. And you know, this is, he's maybe convinced himself of this. It is a horrible, horrible means of control to, you know, have their government lie to them about what's happening to them. And so he does this at the same time as he's effectively lying to Madame Morhange and saying, you know, I'll remember the service that you provided in helping me keep these people under control. So my loathing for Servier continues to grow.
Yeah. Mine too. He has
actually passed Hortense in this episode for me.
Yeah. The other thing that just about this moment again in these sort of these moments that pass by quickly but are sort of devastating is that they're told in that moment, he tells them, they were like, what about our kids? They're still separated from their kids. And he says, oh, you know, we're going to figure it out. Maybe they'll join you. And it's one of those things where in that moment, after seeing them revolt over the children or be, you know, have lots of big reactions. And here they sort of murmur, you know, it's like it's all been beaten out of them. And they don't fight what's happening because, you know, he's telling them the possibility that they'll get their kids back. But they are being put on a train without their children. And that's clear. And it's, yeah.
Yep. It's, you know, they, if you walk into a neighborhood and start killing people, they fight you. If you strip step by step everything they have from them, and at each moment they have reason to comply. One of the things the Nazis figured out is that that is much more effective. You can get compliance with mass murder to a much higher degree if you do it in phases. And this was how they did it.
Yeah. Yeah, there is the banality of evil all through this episode, the quietness of how horrible it is. But you've
raised a really interesting question that I've been thinking about it since you raised it at the beginning of the episode. I'm going to do a little bit of research on over the coming week, which is what was the how did people escape from these transits? And how often did it happen? And how much of it was the way Cohen got out, which is just, you know, slipping somebody a 20? And how much of it were these more sort of daring operations? And I don't really know the answer to that. And I'm curious about it now. Should we understand the improbability of these episodes as, yeah, every time this shit happened, it was improbable, but it did happen? Or should we understand it basically as narrative license?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I find the Mr. Cohen giving up his wedding ring to a gendarme to, like, get out, like, that seems totally plausible. That sounds like a way somebody would get out. Hortense walking into the camp, switching clothes and IDs, and Sarah being able to just walk out, like, after they've already in the case of Helene, we've been told how difficult it is to get in and out, just struck me as uneven. But one other thing but I would be interested in hearing about the escapes and how many of them there were from your research. The one other just piece of storyline that's going on with the resistance is that Cremieux and Marie and Berio, you know, they've got this guy, Victor, who is asking for information about the concrete business that Schwartz runs. And it turns out, you know, he has found Janine's plans to, you know, extend a runway somewhere. And he is able to give the plans to Victor, or to Marie, who gives them to Victor, who says something absurd about how she did a good job, but like for a woman or something. Now I can't remember exactly what he said. And also seemed to also say something anti-Semitic as well. Right. He says something about, I can't remember what he says. Usually I'm better than this, but I forget.
It's about Cremieux and that they're, she raises the issue of saving Cremieux's family.
Right.
And he says that, you know, Jews are always super emotional about their own circumstances. Again, just not believing that the family is going to be killed, believing instead that the family is going to be, you know, away for a few months.
Yeah, that's right. And then also Janine figures out that Schwartz has been through her stuff, confronts him when he gets back. The maid tries to take the fall for it. And
she fires the maid.
And she fires the maid on the spot, even though Schwartz cops to it.
Janine goes through maids pretty quick.
She does. She seems like maybe not a great boss. Maybe.
No, she's not a great person.
Not a great person. Okay. Well, I'm just going to admit that I am glad we are through the 6 episodes of the school.
The train. Yeah.
And I think it is as depleting, they're just sort of depleting episodes. And I remember feeling this way last time.
Really, really looking forward to getting back to affairs among the principal characters, to derring do, and to really, really unhealthy marriage relationships. That's, I think, like the mood I'm in now with respect to the show. I find that stuff much just easier to handle than trainloads of people going to their deaths.
Yes. All right, everybody. I'm just going to, I have been remiss in not doing this enough, but I am going to say at the end of this episode, and I will try to remember it, do it at the future of other episodes, which is to remind people that if you like the podcast, please do go sign up for Bulwark Plus. There are our subscription service where you get all the premium products. We like keeping this stuff free so that anybody can listen to it and we can have these fun conversations. But if you get a chance.
And you get access to the secret podcast, which will, if you listen to it, it will explain all the JVL references and the what must seem to you uninitiated people as an unmotivated feud. One-sided feud between me and some poor guy with the initials JVL. If you listen to the secret podcast, you will understand that my posture is the reasonable one in this relationship. And he's really the one with a bee in his bonnet about me, not the other way around.
That is right. That is right. all right.
But you can't know that unless you sign up for Bulwark Plus and listen to the secret podcast. And also you'll understand the dance that Sarah is doing in the introduction where she can't call me her best friend. She can't call. So she's like figured out this way to navigate. It's like, you know, one of these French village, you know, psycho situations where she's kind of caught between, you know, Mueller and, you know, someone else. I don't know. Like, you know, like if she puts her foot in the wrong place, someone's going to put out a cigarette on her arm.
Yeah, I think that that's maybe an overstatement slightly about how this goes. But if you want to hear me and JVL talk about politics as opposed, in addition to me and Ben talking about this television show about France in 1942, I would encourage you to do so. All right. Thanks, everybody. We will see you next week. Ben.
Yeah, and you'll also get this joke in a way that you probably don't. Edith, take us home.
Nous nous aimions bien tendrement, comme s'aiment tous.